Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you.
We welcome you to Cineversary, a podcast that celebrates a milestone anniversary of a masterful work of cinema. Each month, we send happy birthday wishes to a different film currently observing a joyous jubilee, from a 20th all the way up to a 100th anniversary. This is your devoted host, Eric Martin, creator of the Cineverse blog and moderator of the weekly Cineverse Film Discussion Group. And if you just discovered our program, we want to welcome you. If you're a regular listener, we are, of course, delighted to have you back. Okay, six decades ago, a film was released that stirred the conscience of America and opened eyes to the festering problem of racism and inequality. It also proved to be one of the finest translations of a beloved literary work to hit the big screen, and a picture that captivated audiences with its exceptional performances, including the portrayal given by its leading man as well as the fantastic child actors who charmed viewers everywhere. We are, of course, talking about To Kill a Mockingbird, which first hit theaters on Christmas Day, 1962, a film that continues to teach us important lessons 60 years later. Who do I have joining me this month? Well, it's Chris Hite, a film professor at Allen Hancock College and an award-winning filmmaker, screenwriter, and animator who shares with me a strong passion for this movie. Together, we are going to examine why Mockingbird still matters, themes that continue to resonate, and even problematic aspects of the film. No Cineversary episode would be complete, however, without a bit of contextual prefacing, right? So to get you up to speed on this month's movie, let's turn to the good folks at Wikipedia. What do we know? Well, To Kill a Mockingbird is a 1962 American drama film directed by Robert Mulligan. The screenplay by Horton Foote is based on Harper Lee's 1960 Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. The film stars Gregory Peck as Atticus Finch, Mary Badham as Scout, Philip Alford as Jem, and it marked the film debut of Robert Duvall, William Wyndham, and Alice Ghostly. Mockingbird gained overwhelmingly positive reception for both the critics and the public. It was definitely a box office success, and it earned more than six times its budget. The movie won three Academy Awards, including Best Actor for Gregory Peck, and was nominated for eight awards, including Best Picture. In 1995, Mockingbird was selected by the Library of Congress for preservation in the National Film Registry as culturally, historically, or aesthetically significant. In 2003, the American Film Institute named Atticus Finch the greatest movie hero of the 20th century. In 2007, Mockingbird ranked 25th on the AFI's 10th anniversary list of the greatest American movies of all time. And in 2020, the British Film Institute included it in their list of the 50 films you should see by the age of 15. Visit Rotten Tomatoes and you're going to find that To Kill a Mockingbird garners a 93% fresh rating among critics, where its average critical score is pretty snazzy, 8.9 out of 10, and its audience rating is up there too, 92%. Curious what an actual Mockingbird's song sounds like? All right, listen up. Okay, curious what To Kill a Mockingbird's original theatrical trailer sounds like? Lend an ear.
Ladies and gentlemen, Gregory Peck.
The world never seems as fresh and wonderful, as comforting and terrifying, as good and evil, as it does when seen through the eyes of a child. For a writer to capture that feeling is remarkable. And perhaps that is why one book in the last few years has been so warmly embraced by tens of millions of people. To Kill a Mockingbird, winner of the Pulitzer Prize and just about every other award a book can win. And now, happily, To Kill a Mockingbird becomes a motion picture, and its memorable characters come vividly alive. That Scout, some people call her Jean Louise Finch, but she insists on Scout. And that's her brother, Jim, just a boy until the day he learns there is evil in the world. And Atticus Finch, the father, whose devotion to justice places him and his children in jeopardy.
I've been appointed to defend Tom Robinson.
Now that he's been charged, that's what I intend to do.
You taking his...
You'll excuse me, Mr. Ewell.
Atticus, Jim says this watch is going to belong to him someday.
That's right.
What are you going to give me?
There's a pearl necklace. There's a ring that belonged to your mother. You want to tell us what really happened?
I got something to say. And if you ain't gonna do nothing about it, then you're just a bunch of lousy, yellow, stinking cowards.
To Kill a Mockingbird, a screen classic for all time.
Before we commence with the conversation, let's heed the advice Atticus Finch gives his daughter.
Just learn a single trick, Scout. You get along a lot better with all kinds of folks.
So the trick Atticus is talking about is actually pretty simple. You never really understand a film until you know the narrative first, until you climb inside the story and walk around in it. So put another way, if you haven't yet watched To Kill a Mockingbird, or if you've never picked up the book, why not do so right now? Because the dialogue ahead, it's going to be chock full of spoilers, and you don't want to ruin it for yourself and listen prematurely. Why don't you find out what all the Pulitzer Prize-winning, Academy Award-earning fuss was about and view the movie first. We cool? Okay, one heads up before we introduce our guest. I had a nasty, nasty cold when I recorded the following conversation, so my apologies ahead of time if I sound a bit congested. Just a reminder there, get your flu shot, people, and your COVID boosters, too, so 'tis the season. Everybody ready? Off we go. Let's give it up for Chris Hite, a professor of film and video at Allen Hancock College and an award-winning filmmaker, screenwriter, and animator whose movies have screened at over 50 national and international film festivals. Now, his most recent documentary, Firestorm 77, The True Story of the Honda Canyon Fire, was named Best U.S. Documentary at the Big Bear Film Summit. Chris is also, by the way, a proud member of our Cineverse Film Discussion Group that I mention so often on this podcast. So, yeah, we are thrilled to have you here, Chris. Thank you for saying yes.
Well, thank you, Eric. I'm excited to be here and talk about this incredible film.
Yeah, how are you? How is the academic year going for you?
Well, it's winding up for this fall semester, and it's definitely been one for the record books. There's just a lot going on in terms of academics and issues outside of academia, professional issues I've been involved with. So it's been a great semester, just a very busy one.
Wow. Yeah, a lot on your plate. And how about the filmmaking aspects? What's the latest projects you are working on that you are at liberty to discuss?
Well, as you mentioned, we did just finish up one documentary, which I'm glad to talk about, but we're looking at starting another one, and we're in the initial stages with it, but I can say this much, the subject for the next documentary is filmmaker Roberto Rossellini. And
oh,
so
wow.
We're looking to do a documentary on Rossellini's work and specifically the aspect of his work and how it was received here in the United States, which is a very interesting story.
Yeah, it won't be too long before we'll be delving into some Rossellini, perhaps Rome Open City or something like
Fantastic.
That within the next few years. So he's definitely on the radar.
Incredible filmmaker.
Absolutely. Okay, let us tackle the topic at hand, which is the 60th anniversary of To Kill a Mockingbird. Now, I assume this is an important movie to you. So tell me, do you recall when and where you first watched this film and maybe your first impressions of the movie?
Sure. Well, I can say this. A lot of people come to Kill a Mockingbird actually in high school. It's been a rather established part of high school curriculum for decades now. It's usually teamed up with an assignment where you read the book. For whatever reason, I did not have that experience in high school. I actually didn't come to this film until I was an undergraduate in film school. So I came to it a little later than most people do in their studies on Harper Lee's work and this particular film. But nonetheless, my immediate response was, this is just an extremely powerful film. And then later on, taking in the original novel, I thought, what a successful translation of literature into the screen form, which is always, you hear people say that time and time again when they leave a theater or conclude a screening, well, it wasn't as good as the book. And there's a reality to that. You know, novels do things that filmmaking, which we think of as limitless, really can't. They can take us to ins and outs that are just really difficult to achieve in a cinematic manner without it getting too confusing. But I think this film really captures the spirit and intent of that novel in a way that very few films have done.
Wow. And you were telling me pre-interview here that you actually have taught this. Is it the film or the book or both in your classes?
In terms of my own teaching, just the film. Obviously, there's always carryover where you talk about the book and how that's led into this film being created and some nuance, differences, comparison, contrast between the two. But strictly the film, the cinematic version of this, which is always great to do. This is a film that, you know, I watch a lot of cinema myself in a year at times just by myself. But this is a film that I think just begs to have a group setting, a group screening, because it just inspires such raw emotion and a need for discourse at the conclusion of it. So it's a wonderful film to teach, and it has great relevance to us here in the 21st century.
I'm really curious about this, Chris. So I would imagine most of your students are Gen Z, if not Gen Y.
Yes.
Younger generation, maybe very new to the book, maybe hadn't seen the movie. So you're teaching it in your class. What is the reception? What's the reaction among, you know, younger generations to this film? What have you observed?
Well, I think, again, they also tend to feel it's a very powerful polemic. You know, it's a discourse on an aspect of our society that we're still wrestling with here in 2022. But nonetheless, it's something that impresses them. I think there's a distancing for them. Mm-hmm. You know, there's something about that time period from which this film itself emanates, the 1960s. And then on top of that, we have to consider it's telling a narrative story that occurs 30 years prior to that time even. So there is a little bit of chronological distance for modern viewers in regard to this film. But I think once they get past kind of those superficialities of style and language, they come away with a message that, as I mentioned, it still resonates. It points to things that our society still hasn't exactly solved.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because let's face it, I mean, it's getting tougher. I would think you would agree, perhaps, but that younger viewers, it's a little harder for them to gravitate to or acclimate to black and white movies, older films that are, let's say, older than maybe 20 or 30 years old. And then on top of that, like you said, a story where the setting is, you know, the Great Depression or something like that.
Yes.
It feels more like perhaps a history lesson exercise or kind of a homework assignment or something like, okay, they've been assigned to read the book, which so many high schoolers typically have. And then they usually do a companion, like you said, with the movie.
Yes.
Some people even cheat and skip the book and just watch the movie, which you know, they're being cheated. But the good news about that, as you were saying, is that this is such a great adaptation of the source material, which is so rare, that they're actually getting most of what Harper Lee is getting at.
Absolutely. And I've had many students comment on that in their essays that follow on screening this film, that they initially came to it seeing it as pretty much just an assignment, but found something rather rich, deep, and meaningful once they got into the experience. Both mediums, the book and the film, are just incredible experiences. But the cinematic version, it just imbues it with such an emotional quality that I think you can't necessarily take away from the book unless you have to be really immersed to get that out of the literary version. I'm happy to still show this film in our modern era because I think it just has such great relevance.
Well, it's heartening to hear that your class, from year to year, assuming you continue to show this, they are receptive to it. They are, you know, they come away with a powerful experience, it sounds like.
Absolutely.
So, Chris, I'm curious, how is To Kill a Mockingbird important to you personally? Now, you went through your history of when you first saw it, and now you show it to your students and so forth. But, for example, is this one of your favorite films? Is this one you revisit every few years? And for that matter, how many times would you say you've seen it?
Right. Oh, I've seen it. Wow. I can't even enumerate the amount of times I've seen it since my initial screening. It's been that impactful and powerful to me. This is a strange question for me to answer, but you know, because there's kind of like a bifurcation there, right? Like there's the personal level and is it one of my favorite films? I'd say yes, it's definitely one of my favorite films. How I relate to it personally though is kind of strange, because as I mentioned, I came to it a little later in my college years rather than in high school. And if I'm being honest, there's somewhat of a distance for me on a personal level based on the superficialities of it, right? I didn't grow up in the South, certainly not in the Great Depression. So I've kind of gone through those barriers as well that probably a lot of my students here in California are going through. It's from another time. It's from another place. So I'm in that camp of, in a cultural capacity, it doesn't hold a lot of personal resonance. It wasn't a film that, as I was a child, we watched this film, you know, because as I mentioned, I didn't see it till later. So it's kind of a strange question for me, because personally, it's a little distant, but at the same time, I recognize in this film just an immense power and just a confrontation of ills that when you look at it historically, you were saying, Eric, that some students may look at it as a history lesson. It's an important one, right? This is a moment when a character, a protagonist in Atticus Finch is confronting something that is deeply unpopular in the society that he inhabits. And so this film, in a way, is just a complete deep dive immersion into that old saying of the right thing is still the right thing when it's unpopular, and the wrong thing is still the wrong thing, even though it is popular. And so to see someone really just go up against the forces of everything that's around them and do it with dignity and with his head held high and in front of his children is just a completely powerful experience, regardless of the specific racial polemic that the film addresses. So for me, that's what makes it one of my favorite films. It's such a brave film, especially considering the time it did come from. This pre-1964 civil rights advocacy was just a completely daring thing to do at this time.
Sure. Yeah. I want to trace that chronology, if you will, of, you know, social message pictures, movies that, you know, tackled race relations and bigotry and things of that nature. And as you said, this would have been a very courageous film for that, for its time. I'm not going to give you a soup to nuts, you know, A to Z. Here are the films that were most important, but I will name drop a few of them in just a bit, and kind of, we can kind of go over a few of those if you'd like.
Sure.
But yeah, very cogent, you know, well-articulated response there. So I appreciate that. But let's get into it here, and just in terms of, you know, recognizing the merits of this film, because I personally think it really has stood the test of time, but I'm curious to hear what you have to say. So yeah, has Mockingbird held up? Is it, why is it worth honoring 60 years after its release? And why does it still matter to you?
Standing the test of time, it's a valid question. I respect the question. It's a difficult question to give an absolute answer to at the same time. So movies have changed so much over the last six decades that you almost have to compartmentalize all the varying facets of this film to even be able to answer it some sort of semblance to the question. I'll start with just the filmmaking elements, which to me now in the 21st century, I think are still remarkably strong. The performances are just spot on. I particularly love Russell Harlan's cinematography.
Yes.
It is just, it just is so immersive. It draws you in. It's this fine mix of kind of Wells and Tolan style Citizen Kane cinematography, this mixture of kind of like daylight deep focus, but then it switches to these close-up oblique type of shots, very noirish. And so it's a film that its cinematography, much like the story by a first-time writer with Harper Lee, it goes to a lot of different places. It may not be the orthodox or traditional way to necessarily make its way through a story stylistically or in a narrative capacity, but it just does so many amazing things. And so I think all the elements of the artistic presentation that go into the film are still strong and hold up to this day. I think there's a lot for filmmakers to look at in this film and to just pull away from. That said, the other end of it is just, it is a historic film. And so I teach film history, and the challenge is always to get my students to look at older films from the impact they made upon their release.
Yes.
That's really hard to do. We suffer somewhat from a current time bias in our culture.
Yeah,
we think the
bias.
Moment we are in is completely the pinnacle of enlightenment and art and discourse. And then someone 60 years in the future is looking back at your time and poking holes in it. So we definitely suffer from that. And that's a really hard thing as an educator, when you're working with students, to present a film like this and help them see the resonance and the validity of the film. But I think it does that on its own once they get past kind of the superficialities. So the test of time question, especially if a film like this is difficult, I think it does stand the test of time.
Okay.
But I can understand where now in the 21st century, some of the language that's used, the characterization of black and white relationships in American society, I can see where that comes under scrutiny.
Yeah.
And with valid reasons. We had, as I mentioned, that we have to remember though, it's a 60-year-old film that's tackling a subject that occurs 30 years prior. So even if you put yourself in the mindset of someone in 1963 seeing this film, the question of time and the distance between the events in the narrative and the time they were in was even a relevant question to their era.
Sure.
So all that said, I think the real importance and strength of this film is made apparent when we ask ourselves questions now in 2022. How far has the needle moved on issues of racial and social justice as depicted in this film since the time of its release?
Yeah, good point.
Yes, we've outlawed state-backed systems of segregation in the United States, but conversely, our Supreme Court is possibly going to hear arguments to eliminate laws that were enacted at this same time period to counteract a portion of what was depicted in the film. So I think that's the real power of the film, is it allows us to look at our moment and to ask those tough questions about where we're at. I mean, extrapolate the character of Tom Robinson himself. He's a man who faced an unequal system of justice and ultimately died in police custody.
Right.
That couldn't be any more relevant to the era that we're in, especially the last several years of what
Completely,
we've been
yes.
seeing across the country. So despite the superficialities of style and language, I find this film to still be thought-provoking and challenging 60 years on.
Yeah, great food for thought there, Chris, and completely agree on every point you brought up. So I kind of went through an answer to this question, thought long and hard about, what are the different values and merits that I think help Mockingbird rise to the surface and remain evergreen in 2022 and beyond.
Right.
So I'll echo some of the things you said. But yeah, for me, it's one of the best films about serious adult matters ever told and shown from a child's perspective. And that's thanks to director Robert Mulligan adhering closely to the book by consistently presenting Scout and Jem's point of view and keeping the camera at relatively low angles often. They look up and in awe of adults, and you see that it's really meant to be more from their POV. Not always, but most of the film. And likewise, as you said, the performances are just stellar. Like, they're among the finest and most believable of any child actors ever cast in a Hollywood film. And
yes.
Let's be honest, a lot of older classic Hollywood movies suffer from, when there is a child actor cast, usually it's not the greatest performance.
Right.
Maybe it's not the kid's fault, but often it's not very believable, the actual performance. Here, Mary Badham is Scout. She's only 9 years old at the time. You have John Megna as Dill.
Yes.
I read that he's also 9.
Yes.
And then there's Philip Alford as Jem, and I did the math. I think he's around age 13 here.
Right.
I mean, they're all excellent in their roles and completely riveting to me. Totally plausible. They do and say things that kids their age would do.
Yes.
And interestingly, despite their fine acting, as a bit of trivia, Badham and Alford, they didn't parlay these performances into a long-running acting career, which just astounded me because, wow, they are so above the grain of the typical less-than-stellar child, actor performances.
Yes.
That I would think they would have easily been able to bankroll this into a long-standing career, each of them. But I guess maybe they just weren't as interested. I don't know the context. But anyway,
right.
What amazing performances there. It also feels relevant and important today, Chris, to me anyway, because more Americans in the 21st century have increasingly come to reckon with our nation's shortcomings about racial relations and, our sorry history of racial inequality. This is something that,
yes.
as you were saying, we as a country are collectively coming to better understand and kind of reckon with. And while Mockingbird has some elements that modern audiences may consider problematic, including the concept of an impossibly perfect white savior, the fact that the black characters largely remain on the periphery. Despite these things, this is a morality tale that debatably hasn't lost any of its power to remind viewers how challenging life proved for African Americans at this time in history, and how truly segregated our country was. So I want to address with you, time permitting, some of these problematic elements later. I have a defense for them in my own mind.
Certainly.
But I could understand, as you were saying, how some of these things, you know, 60 years later, it could be a little difficult for some viewers.
Absolutely.
And then just to finish the thought here, Mockingbird also persists as one of the finest and most faithful translations of a beloved and widely read novel ever made. We were talking about this. You know, you consider how often movie adaptations of books, Chris, they fail to live up to readers' expectations. Right. They fail to do justice to the quality of the source material. And this, as we conversed about, this is a rare but prime example of a film that could be equal to the book it is based on.
Yes.
Original authors, they're often dissatisfied with big screen versions of their work, but Harper Lee had said in an interview that she expressed her delight with the finished film product. So that I think that adds a lot of cachet and gravitas to it.
I agree.
When you think about, Chris, the opening title sequence.
Yes.
It's so distinctive and different for an early 1960s film, right? It showcases close-up views of childhood objects, a lot of the things that are in Scout's kind of wheelhouse, things that she and Jem found in the tree hollow. There's crayons, there's jacks, there's coins, there's figurines, there's quick sketches, colorings made by the hands of presumably Scout.
Yes.
Right from the start of the movie, we are immersed in this imaginative world of a child, and that sets the tone and the narrative expectations right from the start. And that's why I think it's so important to remember that this is primarily told from a child's POV. Now, lastly, Chris, the bygone milieu recreated, that of a small town, you know, in 1930s era Alabama. As you were saying, giving credit to the cinematographer in particular, it looks and feels authentic. It's thanks to the fine attention to detail in the areas of architecture, costumes, visual elements that are emblematic of the Great Depression. And then you couple that with the crisp black and white canvas that is rendered expertly by Russell Harlan. You have just such a winning combination visually that you almost can't lose. I mean, these are just backdrops to the main story going on, but they are important to setting the scene.
I agree. I think the visualization on it, it's, you know, the novel, again, I couldn't speak enough praise for it, especially when you consider Lee as a first-time writer. It's a tremendous work, but cinema gives you a layer of visualization that you have to supply on your own as a reader. And what Mulligan and Harlan did, as you mentioned, is just completely authentic. And it allows for that immersion into this world that, from our vantage point now in the 21st century, is 90 years ago.
Yeah.
It just takes you there in such a way as to make it feel comfortable. And I think that's one of the staying powers of the film, is that it connects past and present and allows us to dispense with the elements of the past that maybe we don't understand or we think are no longer relevant. But it points to where the connection point still is and that strong message of the narrative.
Yeah, completely. Okay, so let's try to trace any influences this movie had on the cinema or filmmakers who may have been inspired by it. So what would you say? Do you cite any examples of things that came after Mockingbird that indicate the extent to which this film might have had an influence or inspiration?
I think there's a lot in this film. It becomes somewhat diffuse, right? I think what this film did is it put out some standard practices that you see absorbed by most other films. So I think there's a lot in terms of dramatic structure that, without giving specific film titles, I believe you just see in a variety of movies since then, especially ones based on Law and Order and racial justice issues. Okay. That idea of the gotcha moment, where the public defender exposes the more socially approved of plaintiff, I think is something that this film made in vogue and was quite effective at. That said, To Kill a Mockingbird is somewhat on the tail end of a litany of very effective courtroom dramas that emerged in the late 50s and early 60s.
Yeah.
each bringing something new to the form, and that even Mockingbird probably would have benefited from as well. Certain films come to mind, like Inherit the Wind with Spencer Tracy.
Sure. I was just looking that up. Now, that actually did precede it. That's 1960.
Exactly.
And you think of that as primarily, if not completely, a courtroom drama. Now, it doesn't all take place in the courtroom, nor does this story. And I don't know if people, I can't speak for everybody at painting with a broad brush, but not everybody would say that Mockingbird is considered, let's say, in the subgenre of a courtroom drama.
Certainly
because
not.
It really only is maybe a fifth or so of the running time.
Yes.
It's crucial. Most of your key memories are often associated with, you know, what happens during the trial. But yeah, to your point, nevertheless, you know, that the gotcha moment and the
you know
the eloquence with which Finch is able to defend his client, those are things that you will see in later movies, right?
Yeah, absolutely. That is completely, I think, where most of the influence comes from. But you're correct in that I would see this as a social drama, but definitely with a strong courtroom drama aspect to it. Specifically, one film that preceded it I see a lot in, and it's Otto Preminger's 1957 film Anatomy of a Murder, starring Jimmy Stewart.
Yeah.
And so while Mockingbird, I think, in a way has elevated itself above a number of these other courtroom oriented films that came before it, 12 Angry Men, Compulsion with Orson Welles, I think in a way what it did is it took conventions those other films may have dabbled with initially, and it just did them in such an undeniably cinematic and powerful manner that in a way it becomes the one that everyone looks back to as the wellspring of inspiration. There's a couple other things I think that come out of this film, though, beyond, as you mentioned, Eric, the courtroom aspect. I want to go back to that beginning, which you had mentioned, which I just absolutely love. I think it's one of the most creative opening title sequences I've ever seen in a film. And partially, one aspect that really makes it is Elmer Bernstein's uplifting score, which commences right from the start. It's a subtle score at first, but then it reaches crescendo in a rather short amount of time. And it has such an emotional trajectory to it that it just mirrors the emotional trajectory of the narrative quite well. And I believe you hear this approach to very symphonic score in films that have been made since that time. So I always think of that score and just think of the work that went into it and how it's just such a perfect fit.
This most recent viewing, just thinking about the score a little bit more, I know it's easy to point to the visuals you're seeing as a kind of mirror or echo, but I thought of Spielberg's E.T. and the approach that John Williams takes.
Yes.
Which, you know, he's a bit more bombastic. I love the score for E.T., don't get me wrong. I'm not throwing it under the bus, but what I'm saying is he's a bit more in your face with the score in that film. But there are elements that I could see that he would have picked up from or drawn influence from with Bernstein here. There's kind of a haunting element, an undercurrent of the main theme that you hear when the kids are walking home late or something like that. It just made me think of E.T. a little bit. And I think where there's smoke, there's fire. There are things that you can instantly think of with older movies where you just have an inherent kind of intrinsic feel that this has seeped into the popular culture.
That's right. And it's interesting that you raise Spielberg as part of this discussion because I actually wanted to cite one scene in particular, which I think relates to a Spielberg film. And it's one of my favorite moments in the film. It's the scene where Atticus decides to spend the night outside of the jail to ensure Tom's safety. And we have Jem and Scout and Dill interject themselves in between Atticus and this mob that assembles from Old Sarum.
I know where you're going with this, but I'll let you go. Go with it.
I've seen this convention used in a number of movies and TV shows. You know, the idea of interjecting children to diffuse tension.
Sure.
But there's a very particular moment in Spielberg's Raiders of the Lost Ark in 1981, where Jones, played by Harrison Ford, is surrounded by his nemesis henchman, Belloc, and he's in Cairo. And his friend, Sala, sends in his children as a buffer between him and this mob that's basically surrounded him. And, just talking about Williams and Spielberg's work, I've never read anything definitive from Spielberg on it, but, directors like that that are very closely guarded. They don't want to give up exactly where their influence comes from. But I would find it hard to believe that this film hasn't weighed heavy on Spielberg's professional and artistic career for many decades, because I continuously see elements in his films. But yes, that is one that just always spoke to me. I always see those two together.
Absolutely. I thought of the same thing, and we are simpatico there, sir. Yeah, just to kind of finish this question of tracing that influence, the film version of Mockingbird, it was released at a time of strong racial tensions and, you know, before the passage of the civil rights legislation in 64-65. Although there are predecessors, you know, you have the Jackie Robinson story and also No Way Out. Those are both from 1950. There was The Defiant Ones, that was 1958. All the Young Men, Sergeant Rutledge, that was 1960. Mm-hmm. Now, these films tackled themes at a difficult time, being very courageous predecessors, themes of racism and inequality and segregation before Mockingbird's release in 1962. But Mockingbird proved especially controversial and eye-opening because it wasn't afraid to revisit a time of rampant prejudice, discrimination, and violence in the American South, and also suggests highly sensitive concepts like falsely accusing a black man of attempting to rape a white woman. So I think those predecessors are really important, and I'm not denigrating any one of them, but I think this would have ratcheted up the tension all the more and kind of pushed the boundaries all the more, if you will.
Yes.
And then you think about movies that came in its wake. Now, it's difficult to definitively track the influence of Mockingbird on subsequent films, right?
But yes,
it likely made it easier for later movies to explore similar uncomfortable topics that were overdue for cinematic treatment. Now, in the immediate years following Mockingbird, for example, we saw the release of several similar social message movies, many groundbreaking, such as Free, White, and 21. The same year, 1963, you had Gone Are the Days. There's Black Like Me, and then there's Nothing But a Man. Those are both 1964. The next year, you had A Patch of Blue.
Yes.
And then 67, it's like the floodgates open. You have In the Heat of the Night and Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. So
yes,
by that time, it had been firmly established that Hollywood was not afraid to tackle these topics. And I think that without a picture like Mockingbird kind of in between that fulcrum, maybe you don't have those floodgates open quite as early. Perhaps I'm assigning too much significance to it, but I think this was an important film in that kind of lineage.
I agree. And I think when you look at the whole zeitgeist of films that were coming out, whether, again, courtroom-based or more social-oriented, that we're dealing with racial topics, it's fair to say that Mockingbird does come somewhat on the tail end, again, of a large push towards that, but perhaps it did it more successfully. We have to also consider that this is running parallel and simultaneously to a large art house cinema movement in the United States, which didn't have theaters or films that were filling 1,000 seat theaters at that time. These were smaller houses, but you have a number of films coming in from Europe, films like A Taste of Honey, which were coming out in 1959, were dealing with racial topics, again, largely through a British lens, but nonetheless, when they played at small art house theaters here in the United States, would have definitely stoked conversation, debate, discussion about these very topics in our own society. So yeah, I look at Mockingbird as really coming from a time and place where this was a topic. This wasn't the only film to do it. This was a large topic, obviously, heading into 1964. But this one just so well encapsulated not only that feeling and desire for change, but as you mentioned, tied it to childhood and tied it through the perspective of what children see about us as adults. And there's just something undeniably powerful about that.
Yeah, agreed. And then just to think about more direct descendants, I had not seen these two movies, but in doing the research online, I found that Broken from 2013 and a film called Just Mercy from 2019 drew heavy influence from Mockingbird. So for what it's worth, again, I've not viewed these movies, but they're taking a cue from it more directly. So yeah, that is a pretty strong case for Mockingbird having some powerful influence on some other movies. Let's talk a bit about Gregory Peck and his performance as Atticus Finch. Mm-hmm. Now, this is possibly the most perfect example of a role a Hollywood actor was born to play. What do you admire about Peck's approach to the part?
Wow, it's a fantastic character in both the novel, and then Peck just absolutely solidifies Finch as one of the great characters in cinema history. Peck was kind of in full stride when he took on this role. He had just finished a huge Cinerama format film, How the West Was Won, which featured every A-list actor of the day. And prior to that, he played, again, a lawyer in the original Cape Fear. Mm-hmm. And before that, a military commander. So he has kind of this track history of playing men in positions of power, men who hold the fate of others' lives in their hands. I think there's some things that he does as an actor in this role that were seen as detriments to some of his other acting roles prior to this film. He had often been criticized as being too stiff. And if I'm being honest, I think he is stiff as Atticus, but I think that works to the advantage of the character. The whole point of Atticus here is a man who has been kicked by life as hard as possible. He's lost his wife. He's raising a family in not the most economically mobile part of town. He certainly isn't doing as well as many of his colleagues at the courthouse. And it's during the backdrop of the economic depression to boot.
Yeah.
And then he goes through all this this emotional ups and downs with this court case, which it's never said, but I always got a sense that this came to Atticus. The judge brought it to him personally. I got a sense he was the last in line to come to on this, that no one else wanted to take this case just because it was too hot. And so he's working against a lot of things here. He's looking for respect amongst colleagues. He's doing his best as a single father. But then he loses the case. And the man whose life was in his hands is killed. And so if anyone has a reason to scream at the world, it's Atticus Finch. And yet we never see him do that. He carries on with a quiet dignity. He believes in ideals. He's willing to allow principles to be tested. I just think that's, again, this is one of those characters that's aspirational, I think, for anyone who sees it. You want to have that approach to life. You think of those moments when you've been less than patient with others, when you've been less than fair to others. And you see in a character like Finch, played by Peck, someone who embodies those qualities that we all aspire to. There's a few things that are kind of odd, I think, about the performance that, again, work, though. Whenever we were talking about Mary Badham and Philip Alford, they're all from Alabama. Mm-hmm. And I think that lends to the authenticity. Peck's a little odd. His accent in this film, Gregory Peck was a native Californian, which doesn't necessarily, as a starting point in life, give you the most distinguished accent. And then he cut his teeth in New York theater. And so he spent a lot of time in the Mid-Atlantic region. He worked in Virginia for a time period. And I think he absorbed this real Mid-Atlantic method of speaking and delivery. Mm-hmm. And so when you look at his various characters, you know, his Western gambler in How the West Was Won right before this film speaks of a Mid-Atlantic accent. His Southern lawyer in Cape Fear speaks of a Mid-Atlantic accent. He never really lost that intonation, but with Atticus, they found a way to just absolutely make it work. I think they slowed him down a little bit in his delivery, and it worked to his advantage. He's a character that was supposed to have left Macomb for a time to attend law school. And so his manner of speaking is completely different than, say, the Yules. It distinguishes him, you know, someone who's gone off and got an education. Is it the most authentic accent? I don't know. But it works so well. And again, pointing to Atticus as feeling somewhat out of place in the world that he inhabits, and that he's in these situations where his true southernness or his true believability is in question by those in the community around him, or at least a portion of them. So it's just so many things that really work to his advantage. Things that others may have said, well, those were just his limitations as an actor. But in terms of this role, as you mentioned, it's almost like he was born to play this role.
Yeah, it doesn't feel that way. And I want to address a couple things here quickly. First, just the physicality of the actor, because Peck has this look and you know, think about his voice or even his mannerisms that are just really impressive and not necessarily authentic to, let's say, an Alabama lawyer in 1930s, right, you know, America. But as you had said, he brings so many other qualities to it, and he's able to get away with perhaps an inauthentic accent, for example. And how is he able to do that? Well, to me, this is a thespian who's blessed with so many strong attributes, a strong, valiant chin that projects confidence. He's got these penetrating eyes that ferret out the truth. There's something about Peck's eyes. And then when you put the spectacles on them, I mean, I could see why women get weak-kneed, you know. he's just got this unbelievable charm to him. He's also got this deep, resonant voice that commands respect and an imposing stature. He was 6'3", and that kind of gives him symbolic hierarchy over adjacent performers in this film and a lot of other films he plays in. And he was long considered one of the most handsome actors in Hollywood history, so he's certainly easy on the eyes. But yeah, I think a major reason that Mockingbird has remained evergreen is the exemplary performance by Peck, because, yeah, what does he imbue in this role? Well, as you said, dignity, intelligence, grace, quiet strength, restraint. It helps explain why he was a shoo-in to win the Academy Award for Best Actor for this portrayal. And I want to read you something that Harper Lee said. "That film was a work of art, and there isn't anyone else who could play the part." And then Peck remarked in an interview, "I felt I could climb into Atticus's shoes without any play acting, that I could be him." So I mean, it just feels very natural and organic here.
Yes.
I think what also helps Peck make this character so popular and indelible is that Atticus, he doesn't pontificate. He doesn't speechify. He doesn't come across in the least as self-righteous or superior, even though he is assumedly better educated, more articulate, intrinsically smarter than just about any other character in the story. He's also extremely likable because he's not this authoritarian patriarch. He's not an overconfident or egotistical lawyer. He's not an easily flustered or overly emotional man. What does he do? He demonstrates extreme patience and flexibility with his kids, right?
Right.
He shows the ability to turn the other cheek when he's insulted or challenged. And he expresses this admirable humility among those who look up to him. So it's almost impossible to not like Peck and Atticus Finch. We pointed out some possible flaws, but so minor in the grand scheme of what he brings to this role, my opinion.
Yes, absolutely. And I like your observation on his stature. I don't think you could have someone play this role who is more diminutive than the characters around them in any given scene. He rises above them, literally, but he brings his level of discourse to that same stature. He's not, and it doesn't come off again as didactic or he's trying to shame anyone. In the courtroom, there's moments, but that's all part of the trade. And based on what's at stake, it's valid. But in his interaction with his children and those in the neighborhood, again, he's just a very authentic and humble individual. And I think that's the quality that most people admire in others. Someone who does their job well, but doesn't need to dwell on that success or their competence in that area outside of that moment. They can they can be that person at home and in the neighborhood.
Yeah, it's that humility that really resonates for me.
Yes.
So let's get into themes here, Chris. Mm-hmm. What significant messages or themes from To Kill a Mockingbird are worth examining?
Well, definitely one of the strongest attributes, I think, is just childhood and transitioning into adulthood.
Yeah, it's a coming of age story.
Exactly.
It's a loss of innocence story, right?
There is. And I think it's really encapsulated in one line that Atticus says to Jem after they've had a particularly nasty experience with Mr. Yule. He says, "There's a lot of ugly things in this world, son. I wish I could keep them all away from you, but that's never possible." So though there's a multitude of children in this film and we have different experiences based on what they see, I really look at this story in one regard. The major trajectory is Jem coming into adulthood, learning what his father is about. Because early on, there's been this idea of him questioning Atticus's age. And even Scout even says Jem thinks Atticus is too old. And so,
and he doesn't even call him dad. He calls him Atticus.
That's right. That's right. And so there's this idea of learning to respect someone for who they are and possibly seeing beyond your own prejudices that he had of his own father, right? There's these great moments where we see Jem having these realizations that his father can do great things or can do things. We may not consider him great now, especially at the moment with the dog, but he could step outside of this limitation that perhaps Jem has placed on him. Atticus is just this, you know, he's delimited him to a certain role, but Atticus continuously surprises Jem. He continuously shows him that there's another facet to him that can be strong and forceful when need to be. Definitely that aspect. And of course, just the whole theme of right and wrong. As I mentioned, it's that old adage, right is right, even when it's not popular. That is just one of the strongest threads throughout this whole piece, whether it's in relationship to the courtroom aspect, or just in the lives of the children, you know, doing what's right, scouting her problems at school with getting into fights, etc.
Yeah.
So there's that whole examination. One of the aspects I really like that's kind of more of, I think, an interjection of Mulligan and the cinematic end is the idea of missing family members, specifically mothers. Now, that is in the book, but the way it's treated cinematically is very interesting. So Jem and Scout are obviously missing a mother. Boo Radley has a father, but we never see the mother, even though the mother is mentioned. Dill has a mother who we never see. He has a father, but it's rumored he doesn't have a father. And so he invents all these interesting stories about him. So there's this whole idea of incomplete families. And
yeah, and don't forget Yule's missing wife.
Exactly. Right, exactly. Yeah. So the Yules, there's this idea of lots of children around and Mayella and Mr. Yule, but not so much a mother. And so this whole idea of missing mothers is really pronounced in a cinematic way, right? It's this idea of this matronly aspect of the society is not there specifically, but Mulligan does these interesting things to fill it in. So the character of Maudie, for example, fills in at the breakfast table on the first day of school, whenever Scout and Jem are going out. She sits right next to Atticus where the mother would sit, and they have a conversation with these children as if they are the family. So there's this really interesting examination of missing family members, but then how a community can fill in that void, how it can continue to raise children in the proper way. You know, that old saying about it takes a village. I think we really see that executed in this film quite well. So those are just a few of the elements and themes amongst many that I just find fascinating.
Great food for thought. I never thought about the whole missing maternal aspect of the movie, which makes a lot of sense now, and how it does take a village, and that's kind of a sub theme going on there. I want to touch on what you said, which is, you know, this loss of innocence, coming of age theme.
Yes.
Because again, the tale is primarily told from the point of view of Jem and Scout, and these are two younger children who are taught strong values by their father. They learn hard truths about life and, you know, flawed humanity over the course of about a year and a half. And what do we see? We see Scout begin her life as a school student. I guess it's the first time she's gone to school.
Yes.
I think is insinuated there. Mm-hmm. And she's quickly taught that empathy is the antidote to violence. Scout and Jem, they also learn how ugly and toxic racism is and how dangerous and evil some grown-ups can be. And all of those myths and legends that they perpetuated about Boo Radley, for example, they disappear once they learn how selfless and protective and kind and misunderstood Boo Radley truly is. So the kids come to realize that human beings are capable, like you said, of both good and evil, and that bias, hate, and lies can easily destroy the innocent. They learn that society has an unfair pecking order that elevates some above others. And I think this loss of innocence theme is tied to Atticus's most memorable words in the movie, the famous quote about how it's a sin to kill a mockingbird.
Yes.
With the bird in this context signifying innocent characters in the narrative like Boo Radley, like Tom Robinson, who don't deserve to be silenced, who don't deserve to die. And then you mentioned the famous quote about how there's a lot of ugly things in this world. I wish I could keep them all away from you. Also equally important, his children are beginning to understand the cruel and the callous nature of some human beings. And that's further proof of this transition away from the purity and the simplicity of young childhood. So this is key and crucial to me. But just getting into the main tenet for me from Mockingbird, if there's one key takeaway, not that the rest are, you know, less important, but I think it's the value of empathy.
Yes.
Because Atticus also famously tells Scout, you never really understand a person until you consider things from his point of view, until you climb into his skin and walk around in it. This is like the golden rule to me. I actually try to apply this in my own life, and I'm not saying I learned it from Mockingbird, but it echoes what I believe in my heart, which is you have to see things from the other person's shoes, if you will. And so what's the takeaway there if you were to drill down? To me, it's that it's important not to prematurely judge or condemn others, whether that means, you know, Tom Robinson, Boo Radley, or even Scout's schoolmate who they bring home for a meal.
Yes.
By looking at things from the other person's perspective, especially those who are, you know, considered inferior by or outcast from society, well, we can avoid succumbing to mob mentality or groupthink or rash action. So again, that value of empathy is so crucial here. And then tied in with that is another theme to me, see what you think, giving voice to the voiceless.
Yes.
Atticus is Tom Robinson's defense attorney, given. But he also stands as this kind of unofficial spokesperson of sorts for the African-American townspeople in this story, in this film, who are relegated to the upper gallery of the courthouse, for example. They're discouraged from speaking out or objecting to their treatment by whites in this community. This is perhaps a problematic element of Mockingbird 60 years later, which we can get into next. But
yes,
in this story, in this context, Atticus kind of has to be their voice. And likewise, Boo Radley utters no words, but Atticus, the sheriff, and even Scout speak for him and come to his defense. So, again, giving voice to the voiceless is also important to me.
Yes.
And then lastly, I thought about, you know, the whole mini scene of Atticus revealing that he's a sharpshooter.
Yes.
And he saves his neighborhood, his kids, from the threat of a rabid mad dog. What's the message to take away from there, other than, you know, Jem is impressed, like, wow, my dad has some cool ass skills that I didn't know he had, right? I think it's more than that. I think the takeaway, perhaps, tell me if you disagree, is that true leadership, as well as survivability for that matter, it requires what? It requires grace under pressure. It requires a steady aim. And Atticus's hidden sharpshooting prowess, revealed when he kills that mad dog that threatens his family, is representative to me of his aptitude for zeroing in on and hitting a target, whether that be a literal or a figurative target.
Yes.
I think that the filmmakers, and Harper Lee for that matter, are trying to tell us a little something more than just, wow, Atticus is a man of many talents.
Absolutely. The scene with the rabid dog, if taken literally, again, is one of those moments that I think modern audiences are just going to reject and not really understand its relevance to the piece. But in a way, the symbolism of that moment, that Atticus is protecting these children from this diseased, crazed, violent entity, is what the dog represents.
Yeah.
It's the same thing he's doing in standing up to the old Sarum mob. And the children are learning. It's got a pretty fierce creek of American society in this film, right? Mm-hmm. Because they're being taught that you don't judge others. You know, the whole moment with Walter Cunningham at the dinner table and Scout not liking how he prepares his food and her having to be corrected by Calpurnia over that, and how we don't treat people differently with disdain or condescend to them. The children are learning good interpersonal values of how you treat other people.
Yes.
By the same token, they're going to witness a society that meters out unequal justice. There was no reason for Tom Robinson to lose that court case. There just was not sufficient evidence. That was based on a invisible code that had to be upheld at that point in time. And so they're learning the hard reality of not only just life, we can talk about it in these grand terms, but of life in the United States.
Yes.
And how that there are different systems of justice. There are different experiences for people based on their economic status. Mm-hmm. And Atticus is slowly bringing them to that realization. He doesn't want to do it all at once because he knows that's a lot to take in. And so he's easing them into that.
For sure. Despite Mockingbird's widespread popularity and positive reviews, some have pointedly criticized the work as dated and racially problematic. So I'm going to give you a few examples, and then I'm going to ask your take on these critiques, Chris. In his 2001 review, Roger Ebert wrote, To Kill a Mockingbird, set in Macomb, Alabama in 1932, uses the realities of its time only as a backdrop for the portrait of a brave white liberal. It expresses the liberal pieties of a more innocent time, the early 1960s, and it goes very easy on the realities of small-town Alabama in the 1930s. Ebert adds that, during the sequence where Atticus drives out to inform Tom's wife of her husband's death, quote, the black people in this scene are not treated as characters, but as props, and they're kept entirely in long shot. The close-ups are reserved for the white hero and villain, unquote. And then you go back to the review from Andrew Saris with The Village Voice. This was back in 1963, his critique. He said, as usual, the Negro is less a rounded character than a liberal construct, a projection of the moral superiority Negroes supposedly attain through their suffering and degradation. Brock Peters, as Tom Robinson, tries hard to break through the layers of moral whitewash, but is finally smothered by Peck's unctuous nobility, unquote. So there are a couple examples, and there's others that I've uncovered, where it's easy to kind of poke holes and to find some flaws, and fairly so. But what's your take here?
Well, I think these critiques are valid. certainly in a modern capacity. They most likely wouldn't. Saris is probably closer than any critique we have of the film than that would have emerged at that time. Mm-hmm. But the reality is it's a pre-1964 civil rights film, and it definitely casts the white protagonist as the hero rather than giving prominent voice to the black characters. And as we mentioned earlier, it would be a few years till we actually see a reversal of that dynamic, especially in the most mainstream capacity, 1967 Poitier films, Who's Coming to Dinner and The Heat of the Night, both mainstream films that foreground race from a black American perspective. Mm-hmm. We have to remember that Mockingbird still originates from that novel by Harper Lee, and her whole intention on that novel, as she has stated, was to write her observations of growing up in a segregated, white dominated society. So in that regard, it is a story that's true to its time. Expecting it to do more than that may not be realistic. Mm-hmm. So while the film isn't quite as progressive as we want it to be now in 2022, it's a film that seemingly had to be made. As you mentioned, it's a fulcrum. It's the bridge to the next level.
Yes.
These things don't just emerge out of a vacuum as if they were waiting to happen. So it represents a society that was really busting at the seams in regard to race relations. And so I think if we just allow our expectations of it to be what it is and not have to answer the questions. And as I stated earlier, we can poke holes in it, but the real test of the film is, where are we in 2023? We're wrestling with some of these same questions that emerged 60 years earlier. And so it's easy to kind of Monday morning quarterback this, but the real test is, have we moved the needle? So while not perfect in what it conveys, this film definitely came along at the right time, and it spoke to some uncomfortable truths about American society.
Yeah. Sign me up. I totally agree. My defense quickly of Mockingbird from its detractors is that you have to ponder, Chris, how the characters and the events are conveyed through the eyes and recollections of kids.
Yes.
It's Scout and Jem primarily. Now, we may not actually be seeing through their eyes in the courtroom.
Right.
But they're kind of soaking all this in, and the story is framed as a recollection of, you know, we hear Scout's words. So it's presumably her recollections as an adult of her childhood experiences. So what does that tell you? Well, Scout in particular idolizes her father as a somewhat larger than life figure, and it's easier to accept that while the children can be trusted as reliable narrators, the world and the figures around them may be depicted as slightly exaggerated, which is perhaps why Atticus has such a robust kind of white savior aura about him.
Yes.
Why Ewell seems like the embodiment of pure evil, you know, not excusing his abhorrent nature, but he's like the devil incarnate in this story. And why possibly the black characters are marginalized. I want to read you something by Paul Sherman of Turner Classic Movies, who wrote this. He said, "The movie is most of all about how Scout and Big Brother Jem have their eyes opened to the world around them, with the realization of racial injustice being just one part of the bigger scope. Remember that it is Atticus who opens their eyes, so it makes sense that he would be given greater significance, unfortunately, at the expense of the African-American characters. That kind of makes sense to me. And furthermore, you kind of parse the conclusion, the aftermath of the trial, right? And what does it tell you? Well, it's downbeat. It's stark.
Yes.
Like you said, Atticus loses the case. Tom is found guilty. Ewell gets away with the crimes of false accusation and even beating his daughter. Mm-hmm. And we're told that Tom died trying to escape, when it's actually easier to believe in the 21st century, Chris, that, you know, Tom was probably secretly killed by the mob or the police while he was in custody.
Absolutely.
In other words, this story doesn't attempt to soften the harsh racist realities of what living in a small Alabama town in the Great Depression must have been like for African Americans. So how are you going to tell this story, you know, believably in a early 1960s context in which there are some limitations?
Absolutely.
In terms of how it's a powder keg of a story. You've got it. There are going to be some constraints on it.
Yes.
And additionally, how realistic would it have been for Harper Lee or Robert Mulligan, the director, to change the story and give more voice or presence or screen time to any of the African-American characters? How realistic would that have been? Again, if we can agree that this is a somewhat subjective telling through Scout and Jem's POV, it stands to reason that they would have pared down their memories of this age to the most essential truths, that their father was a hero and an important role model because he stood up for the innocent and the disadvantaged. So To me, Chris, it makes sense that Atticus commands the most attention in the story as a noble and valiant figure. The other reality is that the town is segregated, right?
Yes.
So Jem and Scout likely would not have had much interaction with African-American characters other than, you know, the cook, Calpurnia.
Yes.
And lastly, although this story and film, they're not perfect, we can agree, it's easy to poke holes in its good intentions 60 years later, thanks to our increased intolerance of racism, thanks to our better understanding of race relations throughout American history. So let's not forget that this movie was a rare example in the early 60s of a social message picture about discrimination. And even if Atticus Finch commands the spotlight at the expense of relatively voiceless black characters, I think the net sum gain remains substantial because at the very least, this movie spoke to white audiences in the early 1960s about social inequality and how a black person couldn't get a fair trial.
Right.
And hopefully it made many whites more aware of these injustices even 60 years later, and it continues to do so today. So put another way, the central message to me, it remains unimpeachable, even though through the lens and the prism of history 60 years later, you know, we could say, yeah, it's not perfect. But still, for what it did at that time, it is extremely admirable.
I agree. I think at the end of the day, ascribing a greater calling to the character of Atticus in this film and him not living up to it per some of his detractors misses the point that I don't think Atticus was attempting to solve the racial dilemma that we have in the United States. He was aware he couldn't do that. What he was simply trying to do was to let his children know he was attempting to do the right thing, even if he couldn't solve it at the end of the day. And I think that's full stop, the message that that character was trying to do.
Yeah.
He's saying, I can't solve the world's problems, but I want to let my children know that at least I tried.
Right.
And that at the end of the day, it's going to take their generation and the next generation to witness this,
sure,
see it, mm-hmm, act on it, and take it further. The understanding of the emotions on this topic is completely valid. But an element of patience is always something that has to, and it's not to our liking, but an element of patience always comes with change. It's never something where you can flip a switch overnight and it just, there's a change. And I think that's where this film really challenges us in that regard.
Yeah, agreed. Okay, we are getting near the end here, Chris, and I always have to ask my guest the penultimate question that is of key importance to me anyway, and I think our listeners too. We're a birthday podcast in the sense that we're celebrating an anniversary. This time it's the 60th anniversary of To Kill a Mockingbird.
Yes.
So it's customary to give presents on birthdays, right? Except it's the fans who continue to get the real gifts. So if I were to ask you, what is To Kill a Mockingbird's greatest gift to viewers? What would you say, Chris?
Well, first I want to say happy birthday to Kill a Mockingbird. I'm glad to be celebrating that birthday with you here, Eric. This film is just, it's continuing relevance on the topic of race relations, obviously, is part of the ongoing discussion in our society. And that's always a gift, that we're never taking anything for granted, that we're never feeling comfortable about what we've achieved. We obviously have still miles to go on this topic. But I think the manner in which this film crystallizes youth and the moments of growing up and learning the hard truths about the world around us, whether that's in relationship to race or any other facet, is something particularly that older viewers can appreciate, because it gives us an opportunity to look back on lessons learned, the moments in our life that have shaped us all individually, and who were the heroes in that moment, regardless of what the topic was. And in general, just a masterful use of storytelling that takes us into another time and place, allows us to emerge with a better understanding of where we are now in the 21st century, and to ponder how much work has been done and how much work has yet to be done. So I think those are the ongoing gifts of this film. Just to step back into the idea of criticism of it, I think the criticisms are also the positives, right? That it doesn't solve things. It doesn't neatly wrap up in a bow the issue of racial problems. It can't. It's a film.
No, no.
It's a film about one man's struggle against an enormous force that's in favor of keeping things status quo. So in that regard, that criticism that it doesn't solve things or doesn't take the right steps is partially its gift, because it's not a perfect film, and it's not claiming that it's a perfect film. It's not claiming it has all the answers, but it is asking us to look inwards. It's looking to us to find our own way of dealing with problems in the heroic manner that Atticus did deal with them, to the best of his ability, with the best of the materials that he had at his disposal. And at the end of the day, to be able to look himself in the mirror and say, I tried. Was it enough? I don't know, but at least I tried.
Hear, hear, brother. Great thoughts. Well articulated. Yeah. I'm going to go in a little different direction as far as answering this question about the greatest gift. So to me, Mockingbird's greatest gift is that it serves as kind of a familial wish fulfillment vehicle for audiences. It presents many viewers with an ideal father that they never had, okay? Mm-hmm. While he's certainly not superhuman, he's not flawless. Remember, I mean, he does wear glasses, he doesn't keep the closest tabs on his kids, and he loses the trial, right? He's not perfect.
Yes.
Nevertheless, Atticus Finch possesses many of the traits and values and behaviors that virtually anyone would want if they were designing the nearly perfect patriarch. Patience, tolerance, warmth, inclusivity, courage, self-discipline, eloquence, integrity, decency. It's little wonder then why Atticus Finch placed number one on the American Film Institute's list of the greatest film heroes a few years back, or why he was named the most inspiring character in literature, according to a poll of UK adults taken in 2016. And for that matter, Harper Lee's work, if you're curious, it was voted America's best loved novel in a 2018 PBS survey.
Wow.
People still love this character and this book. So Atticus Finch, his unflappable dignity, coupled with Gregory Peck's stoic good looks, it makes it easy to understand why Finch is the ultimate father figure to children everywhere, why men continually seek to model from his example, and why women, a lot of them still get weak knee just thinking about him. I think the world would be a much better place if we all had just a little more Atticus in us.
Yes.
So that's my take.
I agree.
On the greatest gift.
Great summation.
So, Chris, you were kind of teasing about some things upcoming. So anything more you can tell us about, what you're working on,
sure.
Things in the works, maybe a future documentary or other film?
Well, as was mentioned, my last documentary, Firestorm 77, can be screened on Amazon, iTunes, Canopy, and a number of other streaming sites.
Great.
I have an essay on Italian cinema that will be published here in 2023, which I'm really looking forward to.
And where will that be published?
I'm not certain the publisher yet. I'm working with the University of Rome on this one, and they're still sorting out their publishing details on it.
Okay.
But it'll be an essay on Italian cinema in the United States. I'm really interested in the reception and response to cinema over here. And along with that, that leads to my next documentary film project, which is a documentary on the reception and response to Roberto Rossellini's magnificent neorealist films like Rome, Open City, Paisan, The Miracle, through the 1950s and much of the controversy that came with them. So looking immensely forward to diving into that and just making that come to life. It's a long road, but
I know you wear so many hats. Hats off to you, sir, because
thank you. You
are a busy guy. And I know sometimes you make time to join us on our film discussion group. We always appreciate your presence when you can join us. And boy, would I love to be a student in your classroom. That would be a lot of fun.
Well, we'll save a seat for you, Eric.
There you go. At least an honorary one.
Yes.
So, Chris, it was wonderful taking a long walk with you around To Kill a Mockingbird, one of our shared favorite films. Yeah, thanks ever so much for climbing aboard this train that is Cineversary and sharing your knowledge and opinions. It was a lot of fun.
Thanks, Eric. I really enjoyed this.
Happy holidays to you and yours.
All right. Thank you.
Yeah, such a fun and engaging exchange with Chris Hite, who I first got to meet earlier this year when he asked to join our weekly Cineverse film discussion group. Got to tell you, it's been a pleasure having Chris aboard for many of our weekly conversations this year. Actually, he's one of two film professors who are fairly regular Cineverse members, the other being Barna Donovan. You might remember that name. He was my guest on Cineversary episodes number 12 and number 38 when we covered anniversaries for Easy Rider and The Last Picture Show, respectively. You know, I'm really proud that we have two esteemed film faculty as part of our Cineverse group and also part of our Cineversary podcast. It's pretty cool. By the way, you don't have to be a Cineverse member to listen to our weekly recorded group discussions. Simply visit cineversegroup.com and you'll see postings of our latest group conversations. You could also go to tinyurl.com/cineversepodcasts and you can access a library of hundreds of group recordings dating back to 2007. So in a way, our group has been unofficially podcasting for about 15 years, and you can reap the benefits of those meetings by hearing our raw, unedited discussion recordings if you want to give them a whirl. Now, fair warning, the audio quality on some of those recordings are better than others, so be patient, please. Time now for standing ovations. This is where I give a shout out to a film, website, book, TV program, podcast, or other work that I think would be of interest to classic film lovers just like you. What's my pick for December? Well, it's one that actually hit theaters a month ago. It's Steven Spielberg's semi-autobiographical film, The Fablemans, and I gotta tell you, I loved every minute of it. Now, granted, I am a huge Spielberg fan, so I'm a bit biased here, but what I loved about this movie was the honesty of its emotions, and there are a lot of feelings and emotions explored in a coming-of-age story that examines the slow breakup of a marriage, the dynamics and interrelationships within a fractured family, and even the compromises that artists must make when attempting to pursue their true passions. I really found this a moving, enriching, insightful treatise on what it's like to grow up gifted and yet vulnerable. And if you're a film lover, you're going to adore the cinematic discoveries that young Sammy Fableman, standing in for Steven, makes as he matures from a wee one mesmerized by the mysterious power of movies, to a precocious and innately talented teenager honing his craft, to a young adult looking for his big break in pictures. The performances, you've got Gabriel LaBelle as Sammy, Michelle Williams, Paul Dano, those are his parents, Seth Rogen is Benny, and you've got Judd Hirsch as Uncle Boris. These characters are going to linger with you long after the lights come up. And the ending of The Fablemans is one of the very finest cappers I've experienced in a movie theater in many a moon. Seriously. Quick hint, watch out for a scene-stealing cameo at the conclusion and pay attention to the very final shot before the credits roll. It'll pay off. So take a break from all the intergalactic adventures and the superhero escapades and the CGI epics and the binge streaming. Do yourself a favor this holiday season. Take a loved one to see The Fablemans and rediscover the magic of a simple human story based on real people, not Pandorans with blue skin or computer-generated pussycats. Even if you're not a Spielberg nut, I'm confident you'll walk away impressed. Like what you hear on Cineversary? We'd love to get your feedback. Whether you want to nominate a movie for a future anniversary episode, provide comments, or just have a question, get a hold of us at cineversegroup@gmail.com. That's cineverse group@gmail.com. Also, you can really help our show grow by spreading the good word about the Cineversary podcast to your friends and loved ones. Even better, please leave a positive online review and rating, which significantly helps us get discovered by new listeners. So if you use Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or CastBox, simply search for the Cineversary page, look for a link that says something like ratings or reviews, click that, and leave that rating or review. While you're at it, take a moment to like us on Facebook, too. And if you'd like to go an extra step and help keep our show ad-free, consider making a donation to the Cineversary podcast by visiting tinyurl.com/donatecineversary. We really appreciate your support. Lastly, we encourage you to visit cineversegroup.com. That's the portal for my private film discussion group I launched back in 2005, where you can hear recordings of our group discussions and read in-depth analyses about the different movies we study. Here we are. We've come to the end of another year of Cineversary, and that begs the question, what do we have planned to kick off 2023? Well, our New Year's resolution will be to pay proper respect to more movies deserving of kudos and attention, and we're going to begin that pledge by shining the spotlight on the film Alfred Hitchcock called his personal favorite, Shadow of a Doubt, which marks an 80th birthday next month. Until next time, this is your humble host, Eric Martin, reminding you to butter up that popcorn, live a big screen surround sound life, and cherish those classic movies because they're not getting older, they're just getting better. Thanks for giving us a listen.